This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Into Russia's all-out war on Ukraine, the US, which has been providing vital support for Kyiv, is now changing tack and is weighing in as a peace broker. But each warring side has a different vision of peace, and this brings into sharp focus the fate of the territories captured by Moscow. Russia calls them liberated. Ukraine calls them temporarily occupied. It all started with Crimea in 2014.
There was virtually no bloodshed when Crimea was annexed, mainly because the Ukrainian government was in shambles at the time. The Ukrainian military was unable to mount any kind of serious resistance.
In Moscow at the time, I saw slogans on the street saying, "Krim nash, Crimea is ours." It was very much the idea that this was Crimea coming home to its motherland.
Shortly after Crimea was annexed, parts of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions declared independence from Ukraine. A story journalists have been struggling to tell.
I was mock executed for calling them separatists. They put us against the wall and pretended they were going to kill us.
The occupied territories are in some ways a complete black hole. We don't know exactly what goes on there.
People who actively support the Ukrainian cause, that is being violently destroyed. You disagree, you die. It's as simple as that.
From the so-called polite annexation of Crimea to the creeping invasion of Donbas to what residents describe as a human safari in Kherson, Russia's attempted conquest of Ukraine gets more dramatic and more difficult to piece together. In this episode, we explore some of the methods the Kremlin uses to erase the Ukrainian identity of occupied territories. We'll try to understand how entrenched has Russia made itself there, and what that means for the prospect for peace. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Krassi Twig, and this is the Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring, where we look at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda, and the disinformation.
Радіо Тегран.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
조종 두 당 두 나라 최고령도자 동지들께서는
Until 2014, Crimea was an undisputed part of Ukraine, even though it had a complicated history and its population spoke mainly Russian. The peninsula on the Black Sea, once part of the Soviet Union, has a special place in Russian hearts. Our guides to this contested region are two colleagues who spent their childhood there. Here's Jafer Umerov from the BBC's Ukrainian service.
I was born in an independent country, fairly democratic. We were just three Europeans trying to build our future there.
That country was Ukraine.
Yeah.
What was your identity? What did you grow
up
as?
Yeah, I mean, I identify myself as a Ukrainian citizen, but ethnically I'm Crimean.
And you are the only Crimean Tatar in the BBC.
Well, yeah, I'm the only one here.
So your ethnicity is clear, it's Crimean Tatar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just wondering, did you ask yourself, why are we speaking in Russian?
I actually did. I've never been in Russia, and for me, my country is Ukraine. I questioned myself, why do we actually speak Russian? Obviously, I didn't know the historical aspect back then, but we never saw ourselves as Russians. Crimea has always been a melting pot of cultures. Armenians, Georgians, Germans, Koreans, Bulgarians, and Ukrainians, Russians. But now it is mostly considered Russian.
Yana Lyushnevskaya from BBC Monitoring's Kyiv team also remembers those days with fondness. Her childhood impressions, too, are from post-Soviet independent Ukraine.
In the 1990s and 2000s, Crimea was just a usual Ukrainian region. You could take the train from Simferopol, the capital of Crimea, to Kiev or Kharkiv or Lviv. You could go to Moscow, of course. So much more of the world was open to you. And I cannot imagine growing up without that. I had a lot of pro-Russian teachers, nostalgic for the Soviet Union, but I also had a lot of access to alternative information. Currently, Crimea is very isolated, both geographically and mentally.
There are hints in what Yana said about Crimea's closeness to Moscow. Jen Monahan, who watches Russian media for BBC Monitoring, has the Russian perspective.
Moscow has always seen Ukraine as being within its sphere of influence. More than that, Russia has a significant military presence in Crimea. Going back to the 1700s, it's a strategic location on the Black Sea. From there, ships can access the Mediterranean and from there out into Africa.
Going further back, Crimea was part of the Ottoman Empire and was its own country at one point, making money off the slave trade. Crimea has the strategic location of a warm water port, offering a shortcut to the world. And there are other reasons for its allure.
During the Soviet Union, it was a destination for holidaymakers. Children went to summer camps on the peninsula. It's got a warm spot in many Russians' hearts.
But there is a dark side to this socialist holiday paradise. While citizens of the Soviet Union went south to enjoy the sun and the sea, the region's indigenous population was living in exile, far away from their homeland.
In 1944, the Soviet Union mass deported Crimean Tatars from their homeland. My family ended up in Uzbekistan. That's where my parents also were born. Then they moved back to Crimea in 1989. My grandparents, they were moved away from their homes when they were children. They left any possessions they had, but they were moved to Central Asia. They were just left in the field with no food, nothing. Lots of people died while getting there. It was just train for animals. And the journey took around 20 days. I think it's good to mention that those people were labeled as traitors. It was some sort of a punishment for Crimean population for apparently supporting the German troops. So they wanted to wipe out the whole history of Crimean Tatars. For example, the cemeteries, the stones that were used for roads.
Around 200,000 Crimean Tatars were expelled within days from their homes by Stalin and relocated thousands of kilometers away, mostly in Central Asia. For those who survived the journey, the trauma remained for the rest of their lives.
My grandma, she was moved when she was four. She came back in 1989. She went back to her family house and she saw other people living there, obviously. And they didn't allow her to go in. I could see that pain on her face and that there is still this little child inside of her that suffered through so many things. The Second World War, the deportation, the death of so many people. I mean, she witnessed it. And then an adult woman comes back to see her family house and it's occupied by someone else.
The Crimean Tatars were only allowed to return to their homeland in the late 1980s. In the meantime, the peninsula changed hands, sort of.
Crimea was part of Russia for several centuries until the key year of 1954 when Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader at the time, gave Crimea to Ukraine, which of course was not a big deal because both Ukraine and Russia were part of the Soviet Union. But when the USSR collapsed, Crimea ended up as part of independent Ukraine, which Russia recognized. It recognized Ukraine's borders, including Crimea.
Ukraine declared its independence in 1991. Fast forward a couple of decades, the developments that led to Crimea's next chapter caught many people unawares.
The events of March 2014 in Crimea, it was a bit of a shock. No one really saw this coming.
So the annexation was virtually bloodless, no resistance from the Ukrainian military.
А кто старше, ребят?
Никого не пускать.
What we saw were these little green men, as they were called, unmarked servicemen appearing on the peninsula with weapons, patrolling the streets, occupying key infrastructure, communication centres.
Even though no one saw it coming, the dramatic events in Ukraine at the time provided Russia with an excuse to act.
In 2013, the then Ukrainian president turned his back on an association agreement with the European Union. For many years, Viktor Yanukovych had been playing off the West and Russia against each other. Ultimately, Russia offered him a better deal, discounts on gas supplies, and he decided to turn towards Moscow. This was really the trigger for the revolution in Kiev. People coming out onto the streets and Yanukovych to flee to Russia via Crimea. And then this led to the installation of a pro-Western government. Moscow wasn't best pleased.
The deadly Euromaidan protests, also known as the Revolution of Dignity, were a turning point. Ukraine wanted to be part of the Western world and turned its back on Moscow. Russia's answer was swift.
Двух нових суб'єктів федерації. Республіки Крим і города Севастополь.
In Moscow at the time, I saw slogans on the street saying Крим наш, Crimea is ours. It was very much the idea that this is just a correction of a historical injustice. After the referendum, Crimea was incorporated into Russia, essentially. The stories we do see on state television, very positive, life is rosy in Crimea.
Whether this is how Crimean residents felt it is a different question. The terms and conditions changed almost overnight, starting with identity papers.
They can't leave without the Russian documents now. So you need to have Russian citizenship to open a business, to go to uni, to go to the doctor. The first time I went in 2017 to the place I was born, but I was a tourist there. For them, I was a Ukrainian citizen visiting Crimea.
What were your impressions of how things have changed?
Russia is building roads and hospitals, but the hospitals right now are overwhelmed by the Russian soldiers that are fighting in Ukraine. Crimea, I thought it was going backwards because the freedom of speech was stolen. The freedom of travel was stolen.
We're talking about major changes. The education system changed. The media environment changed. Getting out of the region became so much more complicated.
Given Crimea's historical connection with Russia, it seems it was easier to Russify compared to other places in Ukraine Russia later occupied.
People in Crimea were very nostalgic for the Soviet Union after it collapsed. It was remembered for stability, and that's what people were probably longing for at the time. Crimea was overwhelmingly Russian-speaking before the annexation. And honestly, you would struggle to hear Ukrainian in the streets, like ever. The changes after the annexation were getting rid of everything Ukrainian. In fact, after 2022, you could get in trouble for speaking Ukrainian in the streets, and Ukrainian is no longer studied at schools or universities.
Crimea really was, in some ways, ripe for Russification. There was a huge military presence because of the Black Sea Fleet. When Crimeans voted to join Russia in a disputed referendum, this paved the way for the absorption of Crimea into Russia. We saw the ruble adopted as the currency, education switched to a Russian curriculum. Their population were also immediately considered to be Russian citizens. You need a Russian passport to access certain social benefits, to have property rights.
There's a word for that which both Jen and I struggled to pronounce. Passportization.
Passportizatsiya is a key tool in Russia's hybrid warfare playbook, simplifying the procedure for citizens of a third country to get a Russian passport. Tried and tested before in two breakaway regions of Georgia called South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
How does that work in Crimea?
It's all designed essentially to make it very difficult for non-Russian passport holders to live in Crimea, which is the whole point. Ukrainians that did not want to take a Russian passport had a year to resolve their affairs, either sell up their land, sell up their property, or take a Russian passport.
The large-scale movement of people must have given Crimeans a sense of déjà vu.
Lots of Crimean Tatars are afraid that the deportation that happened in 1944 can happen again, that they once may lose their houses, their lives again. Russians moving from cold provinces, and also lots of families of military men.
For now, it's not quite clear how big this movement of people is.
We've seen a lot of murkiness around the numbers. There's been a concerted effort to move people there.
Президент поставил задачу довести уровень жизни крымчан до общероссийского.
State media highlights the economic benefits. It's all designed to populate it and insert Russia's sovereignty over that land.
The Russians are building apartment blocks. The locals that I talked to had the feeling that those apartment blocks mostly for the newcomers.
In accordance with the official Russian statistics, 240,000 Russians have moved into Crimea since its annexation. Ukraine actually says this number is much higher, around 800,000. Why Russia doesn't really want to make it easy to find out, because of the fact that forcibly changing the composition of a local population is in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
That explains why Moscow is so reluctant to reveal the true scale of the movement. And how does the local population feel about this?
We haven't had any independent opinion polls since 2014, and certainly not since 2022. If you want to find out what's really going on in Crimea, you would have to rely on some kind of anecdotal evidence.
There is zero freedom of speech. People, they feel like they've been monitored all the time.
I would say those who had strong pro-Russian views at the time of the annexation, they still probably have them. But there are also other groups, maybe a majority. They just want to live like a quiet, normal life. And many accepted the annexation, but some of them were not happy with Crimea being used as a staging ground for attacking Ukraine, where their friends and family may live. They're not okay with people being conscripted, returning from fighting in Ukraine as Russian soldiers, coming back dead.
We haven't yet spoken about the media, which plays a fundamental role in the Russian playbook of conquest.
The media environment in Crimea before the annexation was obviously dominated by pro-Russian voices. But, for example, there was a very successful Crimean Tatar channel. There was a website doing high-profile journalistic investigations. There were bureaus of national media. After the annexation, there was pressure from the new pro-Russian government, local militia, who could show up at your editorial office and tell you to leave. Pro-Ukrainian voices still exist, but face a lot of danger, and we know of cases when contributors were detained.
We can hear one of the editors of the channel signing off by saying, "Our people have survived under Stalin. We will get through today's challenges too."
I grew up in freedom of speech, freedom of movement. But right now, kids, they live in very different circumstances. They are exposed to the Russian news, the Russian propaganda films. There was some program giving away money for those kids.
Привет, гражданин Российской Федерации. Ты уже слышал про Пушкинскую карту?
And it's called Pushkin card. So you could use those credits on cinemas and theaters, but only for Russian-made films. So they would go and actually absorb the propaganda even more.
Ukraine has been trying to assert its own narrative with its own TV channel, Freedom TV.
February 26th is the day of resistance to the occupation of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea. Crimea was, is, and always will be Ukraine. Good afternoon.
Ukrainian government been saying a lot of propaganda in terms of giving the clear timeline when they're going to capture it back to give some hope to those people.
Ukraine clearly hasn't given up on getting Crimea back. But how feasible would that be?
There are so many new Crimeans that have never seen Ukraine. They don't speak Ukrainian and they are exposed to the Russian popular culture and the Russian propaganda as well. Most of Crimeans have moved on.
We need to understand that Crimea is not a war zone like other regions in Ukraine. Russia promised stability and prosperity to Crimea. The main narrative was that we saved you from the chaos that you're seeing in Ukraine. You should be grateful to us. But it turns out that Russia did not bring stability or prosperity. It also brought war.
Lots of pundits say that Ukraine won the war in Black Sea, but Russians got 20% of Ukrainian territory. They're moving forward.
You are listening to The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring. We go to Donbas in the east, where the information war went into top gear. A little caveat, we'll use the name Donbas to describe the territories occupied by Russia, which is not the whole geographical entity. Our guide to this region is a BBC colleague who grew up there.
I was born in what was Donetsk Oblast or region of the then Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. In a Russian-speaking family, in a Russian-speaking mining town.
We'll call him Stas, although this is not his real name, to protect him and his family.
My formative years came during Ukraine's independence. At the time, at schools, both Russian and Ukrainian were taught simultaneously. Back then, being a citizen of East Ukraine meant that you knew both Russian and Ukrainian.
It's not hard to see why, having annexed Crimea, Russia turned its gaze towards eastern Ukraine, which is predominantly Russian-speaking. Jen Monahan has been keeping an eye on Moscow's moves there.
Donbas, which is short for the Donetsk Basin, it's an area of eastern Ukraine, rich in coal, traditional centre of industry for many years, going back to the Tsarist Russian Empire.
Like Crimea, Donbas has been historically influenced by Russia. In 2014, as Kyiv became a battleground during the Maidan Revolution, with protesters demanding that the country turns west, eastern Ukraine was pulling in the opposite direction. This is the sound of pro-Russian rallies there.
After the annexation of Crimea, there was an attempt by, they would call themselves local militia in eastern Ukraine, to form these separatist states, as they would call it, the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, that essentially act as proxies of Moscow. They were supported politically, militarily, economically by Moscow.
Their acronyms, DPR and LPR, or in Cyrillic, DNR and LNR, is now mainly used as a synonym for captured regions. Russia considers them liberated.
As Stas already hinted, for many residents of eastern Ukraine, the question of identity is not clear-cut.
TV was available both in Ukrainian and Russian. Many Ukrainian TV channels, there were two hosts, one would speak Ukrainian and another one Russian.
Давайте згадаємо програми, які вже стали частиною нашого життя. Сьогодні ми
пригласили людей, які... Russian music was heard everywhere. Many films were dubbed in Russian. But then the Ukrainian language quotas became bigger.
The Ukrainian language quotas are important for this story. In 2016, Kyiv enacted a law requiring a certain amount of Ukrainian content to be broadcast. The aim was to reduce the dominance of Russian on air, but that provoked international criticism.
When I grew up, many local channels rebroadcasted Russian major TV channels. Ukrainian TV channels still carried Russian news bulletins. First, we had подробности or details, the Russian language Ukrainian newscast about Ukraine, where they would speak president, they meant Ukrainian president. But then you would have время or time. The main Russian TV newscast. And when referring to the president, they meant Russian president.
This isn't simply a bilingual media scene. The split is between national content and broadcasts from another country. Quite possibly a confusing experience for the audience. No wonder the question of identity is so complicated here.
Many people considered themselves ethnic Russians because they would speak Russian. But in our passports, we were all Ukrainians. independently of who we felt regarding our ethnicity.
So you were a little bit of both?
For me, it was always a struggle because I wanted always to find the golden middle of it.
But if finding the golden middle might work in peacetime, war brings the question of belonging to the fore. When Russia annexed Crimea, it astonished the world. But Kiev quickly understood that this was just a prelude. Let's hear from Yana Lushnevskaya.
Eastern Ukraine was likely to become Russia's next target. The Ukrainian government decided to fight back against those pro-Russian militants who attempted to take power there. And then came two very violent years in 2014 and 15. And then a simmering conflict that exploded again with the full-scale invasion in 2022. Moscow recognized the independence of the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. And then in September 2022, it included them in the Russian constitution as Russian territory.
Хочу подчеркнуть, что это реакция зала.
Moscow always denied having any implicit involvement with those proxy states. A key part of Russia's foreign and military policy is deflect, deny, divert. We've seen this from Putin himself.
But despite Moscow's initial approach of deflect, deny, and divert, the evidence has been clear.
Грохот обстрелов не стихает ни днем, ни ночью. В некоторых районах Донецка люди вынуждены...
Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian was on the ground covering the fighting.
We proved that Russian forces were involved full-time in the battles. One of the rebels' officers on the record told us that it was Russian generals who were in charge of the battle for Debaltseve, and he was a messenger between that general and troops on the front line. We exposed direct Russian involvement.
Moscow's creeping invasion came in the form of some interesting characters who were dispatched to Donbas. Let's start with the head of the self-proclaimed DPR, Denis Pushilin.
He had a very colourful past. He was quite heavily involved in a pyramid scheme called MMM, one of the world's largest Ponzi schemes. He replaced the assassinated head of the Donetsk People's Republic, as they call it, and was asking Putin to recognise both Donetsk and Luhansk as independent states, which Putin duly did. And Igor Gherkin, also known as Igor Strelkov, Russia's operative, who was in Crimea prior to the events of 2014, who led a group and successfully captured the town of Slavyansk. He eventually became defence minister of this territory and was involved in the shooting down over Ukraine of MH17, the Malaysian Airlines flight. He's been found guilty by a court in the Netherlands of involvement in this crime.
The downing of MH17, which killed nearly 300 people on board, put Donbas on the international news agenda. What you're about to hear is said to be an intercepted conversation between separatists about the birdie, as they called it. What did people in Donbas make of this tragedy?
It was always communicated only from the separatists, from the pro-Russian perspective. It was not a major news. There was always this narrative that Russia did not do it.
This brings us to the media scene and the sources people rely on.
TV and radio channels were switched off almost instantaneously in 2014.
First thing that Russia does when it starts occupying a new region, it shuts down access to Ukrainian media, and then it starts replacing them with Russian TV channels overnight. There is very little alternative to pro-Russian messaging. Russian media are believed to be trusted more than their local counterparts.
Several local channels in separatist territories quietly ceased to exist a couple of years ago. Interestingly, now both Russian and Ukrainian media seem like a crooked mirror's reflections of each other.
What do the audiences make of all this? Are there strong feelings either way?
Local residents of Russian-held areas don't generally describe them as living under occupation. which can be explained by propaganda, fear of persecution, or just a desire to go on with their lives. It's not North Korea we are talking about, but a population with VPN smartphones and satellite dishes.
So if people want to access independent information, they can, at least in theory.
Anyone living in occupied territory could technically follow the accounts of Ukrainian media on Telegram. If you're stopped in the streets and a local policeman wants to look at your phone, you could get in a lot of trouble for reading Ukrainian news content.
Battles in the Donbas featured prominently in international news at the start of the conflict. But then news from the region became sparse. Authorities didn't make access for the foreign press easy.
Many journalists did not go there because it necessitated the Russian Defense Minister permit, and of course, not many were allowed it.
И под грохот взрывов скорые увозят в больницы Донецка новых пострадавших. Ольга Ившина, BBC, Донецк.
Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian was one of the few to brave the hostile conditions.
I reported from Donbas in 2014 and 2015 till I was banned from entry, and I was actually threatened to be killed a few times. Reporting can be easy if you broadcast pro-Kremlin views. If you try to be independent, then you end up in lots of troubles. If you just pick up the so-called accreditation, you can be detained. Some of us would end up in prison cells. I was mock executed once for calling them separatists. Put it mildly, they disagreed, and then put us against the wall and pretended they were going to kill us. Some of my colleagues were beaten up and kidnapped. If you report something of importance, the biggest question was, will you have enough time to escape? So you had to run for your life.
So what's the story of Donbas, according to Russian state media?
They've highlighted Ukrainian brutality. They will call the Ukrainian army Nazis. The Ukrainian leadership is hell-bent on destroying these pro-Russian people living in eastern Ukraine, fighting for their right to self-determination.
Moscow state media went all out to whip up animosity with the help of a made-up story.
2014, we saw Channel One running a report that cited a woman who claimed Ukrainian forces had crucified a boy in the town square of Slavyansk. This really embodied Russian efforts to create moral outrage at what was happening in eastern Ukraine. It's since been debunked as a fake.
This conflict gave rise to a new class of media operatives.
They are the voyenkori, or military correspondents, as well as the Z-bloggers, commenting actively on events in eastern Ukraine.
Вообще не верю в такое понятие, как объективность журналист.
Борщ, лаш, ЛНР наша.
They have a lot more license to be a lot more critical about what is happening on the ground. They're very pro-war. In fact, they're even more aggressive than perhaps even some in the Russian military.
Russia's war on Ukraine is being fought on many fronts, the media being only one of them.
We've seen Russian education rolled out in the eastern territories of Ukraine. We've seen efforts to eradicate Ukrainian identity.
Over time, the Ukrainian language has disappeared from the DPR constitution and schools. At first, they even used the same textbooks as Ukraine did. They just tore some pages away. Textbooks are now supplied by Russia. They now try to eradicate anti-Stalinist ideas. There is also a lot going on in favor of militarization, children starting to learn how to operate drones.
This sounds very similar to what happened in Crimea. The difference is that some of the efforts at Russification of eastern Ukraine were more gradual.
We have seen the introduction of the ruble after 2014, but in terms of access to Russian social benefits, that's been slightly more protracted.
Russian passports started to be issued in 2019. Over 800,000 passports before the 2022 annexation, according to the local authorities. 3.5 million since the annexation, according to the Russian Interior Minister. And it can be attributed to coercion, as people can apply for more benefits or re-register their property only with Russian passports.
The more people that took up a Russian passport, the greater the pretext for Moscow intervening in eastern Ukraine. To protect Russian speakers and ethnic Russians.
This narrative seems to jar with what's happening on the ground, particularly since the start of the full-scale invasion.
Over time, fears of persecution based on your views has increased. We see reports about people being arrested for spying or just saying something in favor of Ukraine. Distrust has grown way more.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Russia moved to cement its foothold in the east only after the full-scale invasion was launched.
The referenda in 2022 took place in a war zone. The whole process was extremely militarised. We've seen footage of people being forced to go to the ballot box at gunpoint.
You can hear the forceful knocking on doors. This is how ballot boxes were delivered to some homes in the so-called new territories, accompanied by an armed soldier.
By no measure was this a free and fair election. But as a result, we saw the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk to vote to join Russia.
People fled to both sides. Inside Ukraine, there have been 4.5 million internally displaced people, of which about 1 million was from the annexed regions. In 2023, the UN estimated that more than 1 million people have fled Ukraine for Russia. Some people are very happy that Russia has defended their right to speak Russian.
In those media, you would hear about how happy people are that Russia supposedly saved them from genocide. These sentiments definitely exist.
Big parts of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions have been experiencing varying degrees of turmoil for the past 11 years. Some estimates put the number of dead in this war at 14,000, even before 2022. After the full-scale invasion, at a time when Russia struggled to boost the number of its soldiers, it must have come in handy to add a new territory as an extra source of manpower.
We saw those occupied areas being used as a bridgehead for attacks on the rest of Ukraine. And we saw residents of Donbas being forcibly mobilized to fight for the Russians.
If we look at the Ministry of Defense statistics from Russia's mobilization in September 2022, when it called up 300,000 people to go and fight, 80,000 from the Donbas, the areas that Russia said it was trying to protect.
And because of the heavy losses on the battlefield, the mobilization was also called mogilization, after the Russian word for grave, mogila. But as useful as these men were for the army, there are hints of them being treated as second-class Russians.
We've also seen videos of captured prisoners of war from the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Appealing to President Putin directly, saying, don't forget about us. You've told us that we're Russian citizens as well. And asking Putin, when are we going to be considered in these prisoner swaps with Ukraine? Because, according to them, priority is given to Russian citizens from mainland Russia. And they're, in their words, being forgotten about.
You are listening to The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring. We are entering the southeast now, the regions around Kherson and Zaporizhia, bordering the Sea of Azov. Much of the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions were taken by Russia after the full-scale invasion started in 2022, but Moscow doesn't see itself as an occupying power. BBC Monitoring's Russia editor Vitaly Shevchenko comes from there and will be our guide.
The first thing that becomes obvious to you is that there's a climate of all-pervasive fear. You can't speak your mind. Secondly, and this is important, the people who are staying there, they're either happy with Russia being there, or they can't leave, or they are never going to speak their mind. To find somebody who is willing to talk, it's very, very difficult.
The BBC takes many precautions to protect the anonymity of people who speak to us. Here's what residents of occupied areas have told Vitaly.
If you speak Ukrainian, you are the enemy. If you play Ukrainian music and somebody overhears you, well, you can be arrested. There are no media or schools that are in Ukrainian. The bottom line is, if it's Ukrainian, it has to go.
If you're watching Russian state media, you'll get a completely different picture. Франциска is watching Russian TV to understand the Kremlin's thinking.
The Kremlin has made efforts to tell Russians that peaceful life is returning to these areas that are now in this happy family of Russia after being under the Ukrainian yoke, where Russian speakers rather than Ukrainian speakers were said to be oppressed by the government in Kiev.
A similar story is being told by media inside the areas captured by Russia. As we've already seen with other occupied territories, taking control of the media is one of the first things Moscow does.
The media outlets that Russia installed there, they're really keen to stress how free it was, how happy the locals were to go and vote for Vladimir Putin and his party.
В Херсонской области стартовал референдум по вопросу вхождения в состав России.
But because these media operatives, I like to call them, they're often not very professional. Sometimes this facade slips and you can peer behind the scenes and what you begin to see is chilling.
Безопасность членов избирательных комиссий и избирателей также обеспечена.
You see men with machine guns sort of looking from behind the corner at polling stations, men wearing military uniforms visiting locals with ballot boxes. Also, the exaggerated happiness of all these voters supposedly overjoyed to be ruled by Russia again. I'm old enough to remember how it was in the Soviet Union. I've seen it before.
Владимир Сальто исполнил заветные мечты двух детей из Херсонской области.
In terms of the media scene, of course, free media, forget it. Media in Ukrainian, forget it. You're not supposed to speak Ukrainian. One good example of how they do it, there's somebody called Alexander Malkevich, an associate of the late mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin. He was dispatched to places like Kherson and Zaporizhia region specifically to set up the right kind of media companies that would broadcast the right sort of message. Ukraine, bad. Russia, good. It's a very uniform picture.
The newly occupied territories don't get a uniform treatment. One city stands out in terms of the money the Russians have poured in to rebuild it after almost completely destroying it.
When Russia launched its assault on Mariupol in the very first days of the full-scale invasion, it was brutal. The UN estimates that 90% of buildings were damaged or destroyed. And I'm talking about a city of almost 500,000 people. There was little to no regard for human life whatsoever.
We all remember these Ukrainian soldiers who were holed up in the Azov-style steel plant for weeks, surviving and staving off the wave after wave of Russian attack. And for Putin, it was a matter of pride to win this battle. It's a matter of showing that this is a Russian city forever and will never be given back to Ukraine. In 2023, President Putin even visited Mariupol under the cover of night, and Russian state TV showed him driving around.
Putin visited specifically to show on television these pictures of brightly coloured apartment blocks. What television didn't see are all the other parts of Mariupol that are still lying in ruins.
Vitaly was saying earlier that many people left those newly occupied areas. We can only guess how many remained. And many newcomers are settling in.
The local Russia-installed authorities, they say that 70,000 people living in Mariupol are members of the Russian military or construction workers who have come from Russia.
The main incentive offered to Russians is the preferable mortgage rate.
2% ипотека, очень доступная.
The average mortgage rate in Russia is about 27%. If you move to somewhere in the occupied territories, you can get a mortgage for just 2%. There's reports of Russians from the wealthy cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg moving there because it's warmer and they can live in a new apartment block. It's somewhere that the Russian state is trying to tell them is safe and is Russia forever. There are jobs going. There's a lot of preference given to soldiers. And this is really all about ripping up the Ukrainian fabric of these places and turning them into Russian cities.
More than 20,000 people are said to have been killed in the battle for Mariupol. The center may have risen from the ashes, but other newly occupied towns are yet to see Russia's constructive side. The city of Kherson, for example, which the Ukrainian army has retaken, witnessed a new and rather chilling phenomenon.
Our listeners may have heard the phrase human safari.
Война с мирным населением приобретает форму буквально сафари на людей.
Residents of Kherson report time and again instances where local buses, ambulances, civilian cars are being targeted by Russian drones for the sole reason of just being there. Russia embarked on a campaign to destroy the city and make life there impossible, to make the city unlivable. I was talking to a prominent Ukrainian comedian, Anton Tomashenko. He told me about a visit. He was in a car and the driver rolled down the windows. And Anton thought, let's breathe in the fresh air. But the driver said, no, we need to have the windows down so we can hear Russian drones approaching.
Russia's efforts at Russification of the newly occupied territories follow a familiar pattern. The media is brought into line, and another target area is education.
If I say the schools are different, that would be a huge understatement. Curriculum was in Ukrainian, about Ukraine, and what we have now, language, Russian, textbooks, Russian, ideology, Russian. It's all about how great Russia is.
Since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia has taken pains to almost re-educate its youth. Vladimir Medinsky, an aide to Putin, has co-authored a new series of history textbooks.
Новая Россия – это гораздо больше того, что мы представляем себе даже сегодня.
Which paint Russia in the light of this proud, victorious nation. And these textbooks are also aimed at molding this younger generation of Ukrainians, making them grow up as Russians, trying to create a break with their Ukrainian past.
How are they making this stuff appealing to the young generation?
We've seen a number of comic books focusing on the Russian invasion of Ukraine coming from the Russian Defense Ministry. And one in particular turned the colonel accused of carrying out war crimes in the town of Bucha by the name of Umurbekov in some kind of hero rather than a war criminal or a villain.
There's more to youth indoctrination than textbooks.
In October 2022, Yunarmiya, which is the Russian youth army, opened offices across the four annexed regions. And in 2023, offices were set up for this movement called the Movement of the First, aimed at educating young Russians from the age of six. The Movement of the First was set up by Putin, and he continues to be its main patron and has even discussed giving it the name of Pioneers, which is what the main youth movement in the Soviet Union was called.
The local authorities don't shy away from reminding parents about their duty to send their children to Russian schools or face the consequences. This chilling recording is from Lazurne in the occupied Kherson region.
We have a list of children whose parents didn't send them to school. My dears, we would welcome you, even if speaking Ukrainian. Would you respect the laws of the country that has taken you in? This is Russia. We have laws. Your behavior will be punished harshly and mercilessly.
Jana is closely following events in the newly occupied territories.
We've heard of cases where headmasters would be kidnapped, arrested, and pressured into switching to Russian curriculum. And one of the stories that I heard is that parents, they're also cautious about making their children too pro-Ukrainian because they might come into school and say something controversial and then the child and the parents will get into trouble.
But despite the dangers, there is some pushback. Vitaly found evidence of clandestine efforts to offer some Ukrainian lessons to children in the occupied territories.
I've seen reports suggesting that by day, children, they go to Russian schools, but after that formal schooling is over, they attend Ukrainian classes. Huge efforts are being made to conceal their identity, because if anybody finds out, it's extremely dangerous. Tens of thousands of Ukrainian children are believed to have been abducted by Russia. How? Why? Because a lot of them, they've lost their parents, because they were killed or imprisoned. That's an example of the price Ukrainian parents can pay by refusing to allow their children to be indoctrinated. You can get killed, you can get jailed, and your children can be taken away and indoctrinated in Russia.
We know the names of tens of thousands of children kidnapped by Russia.
In 2023, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin and his Children's Rights Commissioner, Maria Lvova-Belova, for the alleged abduction of Ukrainian children. You can hear them discuss on Russian TV how she has adopted a boy from Donbas. The Kremlin has been consistently rejecting the ICC's accusation, saying it's been removing children from a war zone for their own safety.
Maria Lvova-Belova said, those children from Ukraine tried singing the Ukrainian anthem, they chanted glory to Ukraine, they said, and I quote, nasty things about the president, i.e. Vladimir Putin, but it all changed. We worked on them, now they're happy to be in Russia.
She speaks about saving children from the conflict zone and allowing them to be adopted by ostensibly loving Russian families. But of course, some of these children have their names changed, losing their Ukrainian identity. And even if some of them are orphans, many of them do have relatives in Ukraine or Ukrainian relatives who have now left the country. And they find it almost impossible to establish any links with their children or grandchildren.
Vitaly spoke earlier about underground education, and that's not the only manifestation of Ukrainian resistance against the occupying authorities.
If you disagree, you can be killed. That's why Ukrainian resistance in occupied parts of Ukraine takes forms that are easier to carry out and less easy to catch. There's also a group of women called Zla Mavka who are engaged in non-violent forms of protests, such as spraying pro-Ukrainian graffiti or spreading pro-Ukrainian leaflets. They don't even know each other, because if one of them gets captured, she would not be able to reveal who the other members of the group are.
The group spoke to the Ukraina, an independent media project, which provided a voiceover to protect their identities.
Mavka is this forest creature from Ukrainian mythology. It's mostly to show those who may still have pro-Ukrainian views that they're not alone, that they would not feel as isolated and as hopeless.
There are also reports of Ukrainian partisans derailing trains, but it's largely symbolic. Ukrainian propaganda would be interested in creating this impression of a massive resistance movement.
So if you happen to find yourself living under Russian occupation, you can either cooperate, take up some mild form of resistance, or try to leave. Making it out involves a procedure called filtration.
According to the testimony of the people who went through it, it's just as terrible as it sounds. You have to go through a very thorough security check by Russian security forces. They could take you to a detention center. In some cases, families have not heard back from such prisoners again.
Ukraine has listed more than 60,000 people as missing since 2022. All routes out of the occupied territories lead to Russia, if you don't count the front line.
Those who do manage to pass filtration end up in Russia, and then via Belarus and Poland, they would enter Ukraine. And then they would register as IDPs. It's expensive to set up a new life in a new place. And we do get this tragic situation where people need to make a choice whether they're staying in their own country or going back to their home that's currently under occupation just for purely economic reasons.
It sounds like residents of newly occupied areas are getting a rough deal wherever they go. If they manage to make it out of the occupied areas, they could be struggling financially, and back home they face oppressive authorities.
It's a top-down pressure spearheaded by the occupation authorities and often reliant on local collaborators who create an atmosphere of, look, we're here for good, Russia's here to stay, you better conform.
Vitaly has brought up the C word, collaborators. This is a legal area, but it's also an ethical conundrum that has sparked fierce debates in Ukraine and international criticism of Kyiv.
The term collaboration, it was only included in the criminal code in the early days of the full-scale invasion. They concern things like public denial of aggression against Ukraine or public calls to support Russia or voluntarily taking up posts in the occupying state's administrations. People could go to jail for a long time.
People from occupied territories who've taken up jobs under the Russian administration might find themselves between a rock and a hard place. From the Russian side, they face coercion. From the Ukrainian side, the threat of legal prosecution.
The problem with this law, as human rights activists say, is that it doesn't take into account the line between being a collaborator and merely trying to survive in occupation. For example, if you are a teacher and you continue working in your school under occupation, under Russian curriculum, are you a collaborator or not? It's a very kind of gray area, and international organizations have been asking the Ukrainian government to revise this legislation to take into account that for a lot of Ukrainians, it's not really a choice, it's about survival.
So what next for the occupied territories and their people?
The idea that those territories should be allowed to remain occupied by Russia is always rejected.
Україна буде вільною. Будуть звільнені і Херсон, і Нова Каховка.
There are Ukrainian people living there. It would mean abandoning them. Thousands of Ukrainian troops died trying to liberate those regions. Was their sacrifice in vain? Without major security guarantees, leaving those regions under occupation would not really solve anything. That's one of the big narratives, is that as we saw after 2014, Russia's appetite only grew after it was basically allowed to have Crimea.
Russia is sparing no effort to entrench itself in occupied parts of Ukraine. Before the Ukrainian forces retook Kherson, a lot of the billboards said, Russia is here for good. Take Russian passports, send your children to camps in Russia. And that is Russia's policy to future-proof itself.
It's clear that the Kremlin is making a concerted effort to erase all trace of Ukrainian society and culture from the occupied territories and replace it with all the trappings of Putin's Russia. And on the battlefield, Russia has now got the upper hand.
So if the conflict continues with the current level of international support for Kyiv or less, one can only assume that Russia will occupy even more territory. And yet, despite Putin's belief that Ukraine is not a real country, over centuries of rule by Russia and other colonial powers, Ukrainians have nevertheless managed to keep the flame of their national identity burning bright.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service, produced by the Global Jigsaw podcast team, Krista Shattery and me, Krassi Twig. Thank you to our experts, Jafar Umerov, Yana Lyushnevskaya, Jen Monahan, Stas, Olga Ivshina, Vitaly Shevchenko and Francis Carr. The sound engineers for this program are John Hemingway and Nick Scripps, and the editor is Judy King. You can find more episodes on this story on the Global Jigsaw podcast feed, and you can watch visualized editions on the BBC World Service YouTube channel. You can keep in touch with us by emailing the Global Jigsaw, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. And thank you for listening.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.